This is Spectator Radio, the Spectator's curated podcast collection.
Welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily podcast. We've had three Tory campaign launches so far today. Jeremy Hunt, Dominic Raab and Matt Hancock. Michael Gove is in a few minutes if he gets that far. But how have the three done that we've seen already? I'm Fraser Nelson and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman and Katie Ball. So Isabel, who did you have the joy of being in company with this morning?
Well, I had a double bill in the Royal Festival Hall this morning. First it was Matt Hancock who did really wake us all up, I think. First he handed us goodie bags with waffles and Matt Hancock branded chargers. And then there was this strange sort of video, a bit like in the Science Museum, where you could only half hear what was going on. A bit like you'd have to plug in with your headphones to find out how electricity was invented or something. And then Matt appeared on the stage to talk to us. And it was like he was sort of trying to decide whether he wanted to be Tory leader or a personal trainer, because he kept saying things like, "I'm not running to fail, I'm running to succeed." And my favourite line was, I am an emotionally charged platform, which made me think twice about ever using the charger that he'd handed out to us in this goodie bag. I mean, what would happen if I plugged it in? And I think that, I mean, this, a lot of it was quite cringeworthy, particularly when he turned to the audience and said, "You are the future of Britain," and found himself staring at a load of haggard political journalists who were thinking, not even we want to be the future of Britain. But I think that cringeworthiness did have a purpose, aside from being kind of pretty sincere Matt Hancock. It was also an attempt to get some attention, because he's in a pretty difficult position as an ex-Remain supporter who has been in Theresa May's cabinet throughout, has been very loyal, is tainted with all the problems of government and of governing next to Theresa May. And he needs to give the party a sense that he can offer something other than continuity. And for him, that's looking forward, that's being really, really excited about the future of Britain, particularly against a really rainy backdrop, which didn't look as fitting as he'd probably hoped. But he was trying to be the optimistic candidate. And there was a contrast when we went downstairs just half an hour later for Dominic Raab's launch, which was a much more serious, sort of heavy set launch in terms of branding. And no goodie bags, no. Lots of MPs. And a joke at the start from Maria Miller about how she was going to persuade Dominic Raab to become a feminist, which initially I thought, why would you highlight this? But I think Raab has decided he's going to be the kind of the brazen candidate who has basically got the backbone to stand up to Brussels and annoy Michel Barnier and Guy Verhofstadt, and to introduce domestic policies that work for ordinary working people. And both Hancock and Raab were clearly trying to take digs at Boris Johnson. They weren't really thinking about the other candidates, actually. But for them, both of them, Matt Hancock talked about only cutting taxes when the country can afford to do that. And Raab talked about achieving Brexit needing to be done by someone who doesn't have bluff and bluster, but a serious plan. So it's clearly Boris who they're all thinking about, even if, as the question and answer sessions afterwards, exactly, strange little hint there. The question and answer sessions afterwards had were dominated by questions about Michael Gove.
Interesting. So, Katie, Michael Gove is supposed to be in the top three probability, along with Jeremy Hunt and Boris Johnson. You saw Jeremy Hunt. How was it for you?
So Jeremy Hunt was making his pitch as the candidate who can unite. Now, that might ring a few bells, because that was also Theresa May's pitch back in the day, the idea that she would be the unity candidate. And I think this is Hunt's problem, which is he seemed very serious. He said it was serious time and that required a serious politician. But you could also argue that he also seemed rather continuity, and his nickname amongst MPs is Theresa in Trousers. Now, he tried to show that he was different, because he had momentum from yesterday, because he got Amber Rudd's endorsement, which led front of several papers today and has got a lot of attention. So she made a few opening remarks. Then they managed to reveal a surprise backer, which is Penny Mordaunt. Now, I actually think the Amber Rudd endorsement, I think, was important, but not really so much perhaps in a positive way to Jeremy Hunt, as because it was negative to other people. Michael Gove had been in talks with Amber Rudd. Matt Hancock would have very much liked the Amber Rudd endorsement. So it showed that people who are in the One Nation caucus, or people who would describe themselves as liberal conservatives, see Jeremy Hunt as perhaps their best bet for having a candidate. But the Penny Mordaunt endorsement, I think, is very important to Jeremy Hunt, because he needs to show that, yes, he voted Remain. Yes, he has said he could potentially delay Brexit past the end of October. So to have Brexiteer backing, I think, is something that he has to show to say that, look, I do want to deliver this. Now, Penny Mordaunt, when she got up to speak, and up until the end of last week, there were rumours that she herself might run.
And she rumours that she was at pains not to deny as well.
Exactly. And I saw some people today say, well, this is mad that everyone is suggesting she might run, you know, a few days ago. And it is worth pointing out that her team were just stopping responding to anyone. So she said that she was backing Jeremy Hunt in part because she was now Defence Secretary and she'd been impressed by his role at the Foreign Office, but also because she trusted him to deliver Brexit. Now, there was something slightly strange in the sense that she said she trusted him to deliver Brexit, and then the Q&A, Jeremy Hunt was pressed repeatedly on how he would deliver Brexit and what he would do in terms of no deal if he would countenance it. Now, about a week ago, a bit more, Jeremy Hunt seemed like he was really suffering in his campaign because he wrote an op-ed in which he said no deal Brexit was akin to suicide for the Tory party because it would lead to an early election. He hasn't quite managed to join up his two positions, I don't think, successfully, of saying that he will countenance a no deal Brexit and saying he will avoid a general election, but he was definitely trying to walk that tightrope. And as with Rob, it had lots of MPs there who were very supportive. I think Penny Mordaunt is by far the most well-known Brexiteer currently backing him, so they'll want some more of that, I think, if he is to continue. But right now, I think when you look at perhaps the cabinet candidate who might make it into the final two, away from the no-deal candidate, someone like Boris Johnson, I think it's Jeremy Hunt who is leading the way.
Interesting. So, Isabel, Michael Gove, then, who was on Friday seen to be cruising for the final two with Boris Johnson, we've since had at 9:30 on Friday the cocaine revelation from the Daily Mail. The Mail on Sunday came up with the story that he was attending a cocaine-fueled party just hours after announcing it when he was my boss at the Times, which he briefly was. So do you think that's it? Do you think he has found out that he unwittingly snorted his way out of this race?
Well, the revelations that are in Owen Bennett's biography of him have certainly taken the contest in an odd direction. It already had quite a kind of a druggish tinge to it, this contest, after Rory Stewart talking about opium. And then I think we had Jeremy Hunt over the weekend saying he'd drunk a cannabis-based drink, which just sounded completely baffling and turned out not to be illegal where he'd drunk it anyway. There has sort of been a weird arms race on who's taken drugs and who hasn't. And Gove is on the front pages. He's dominating the question and answer sessions at other candidates' launches. Journalists asking whether he should pull out of the contest. Now, all the candidates are obviously saying, no, I don't think he should, because who's going to be the one who calls for him to go?
Cast the first stone.
Well, and also they're all trying to maintain the pretense that they're not attacking one another at the moment. So Dominic Raab repeatedly says, in a slightly paranoid way, I think, well, I don't want to speak personally about any of the other candidates, almost as though he expects that they'll hit back with something quite damaging for him. But this is difficult for Gove. The thing I think that would make it, that would give it longevity and that would make it damaging to Gove in the sense of the contest, as opposed to an uncomfortable interview in Anjumar, an uncomfortable few days in the papers, is if it then moves on to a debate about drugs policy, because then you'll have all the Tory candidates having to back up not just what they have done in the past, but also what they think should happen in the future in terms of drugs reform. And that's going to be very difficult for people who've made admissions like Gove, but also believe apparently in a tough drugs policy, or indeed on those who want liberalisation of drugs laws, because that is not popular with the Tory membership, even if they're ambivalent about personal drug use.
And Katie, I imagine at the bottom of this lies an unanswered question: how much do people really care about cocaine use now? I remember when David Cameron stood for leadership in the 2005 Tory party conference, he was on the stage with Andrew Rawnsley and was asked about if he did cocaine, and he basically said, well, I'm not going to go back there. In other words, it was basically saying yes but without formally admitting it. And at the time, people were saying, isn't it incredible, you can basically say this now, it would have ruined you in another era. But then, over the next few days, I think the Daily Mail started the "Was Cameron a cokehead? He has to confess," and it sort of became an issue. Then also, I remember Liam Fox standing against him was pretty much challenging him, saying, "Look, if somebody had asked me if I'd broken the law, I would answer it." So they were making a big deal of it then. But will this really hurt Michael Gove now? Do you think people are likely to think, "Well, you know, surprise, surprise, Oxford Union president was found being a bit of a Dyson noser at weekends.
Well, the Cameron line was always that a politician is entitled to a personal life prior to entering politics. And it seems that if you look at Owen Bennett's book, that was the advice Michael Gove was given when it comes to answering those questions. When in the 2016 leadership contest, he revealed to his advisors the fact that he had used the drug in the past, and they pointed him to that. Now,
and that, interestingly, that's what busted him, because it was Owen Bennett only got this information because Gove had confessed to it while preparing for the debate in 2016. So if he'd done a Cameron, if he just kept quiet, everything would have been fine.
Yeah, and I don't think he had the option available to him because obviously the claims that Owen Bennett had. Now, Michael Gove has clearly been explicit about it. I think that means that he has two potential problems in terms of running for Prime Minister. One is there are voters, many of whom perhaps in the Tory membership, who don't like the sound of it and don't think it is a normal part of their lives. Secondly, I think there are plenty of people who don't think it's a big deal. They do think politicians are entitled to a private life before they are politicians, but they don't like what they see as hypocrisy on drugs policy. And Michael Gove himself, and it was unearthed at the weekend, wrote a piece for The Times in which he basically admitted it was hypocritical of lots of the journalist class to do things like this, but actually he said hypocrisy is bad, but there are some things that are worse than hypocrisy. So he was almost arguing that it's better to be a hypocrite on this than have a drugs policy which argues towards liberalisation just because you yourself perhaps don't live to the high standard that he thinks a law should be. I think in terms of the leadership contest, I don't think this rules out his campaign. What I do think it does, though, is it makes it hard for him to make the final two. And calling round and speaking to MPs who are backing him and have already come out for him, I don't get the sense that any are really planning to move away from him, at least in bulk. But this is a really important week in the Tory leadership contest. This is the start of the parliamentary rounds. You have the first vote on Thursday when you'll start to get an idea of numbers. And we saw at the weekend Sajid Javid getting an endorsement from Ruth Davidson. We saw Jeremy Hunt now having Amber Rudd and Penny Morden. And I think the problem Michael Gove has is that in terms of timing, this is putting, I suppose, big names off coming up out for him at a time when he wants to be building up momentum.
So perhaps we're not going to see too many people now coming towards Gove in the way that we might have done before Friday.
Exactly. And I think he could still get those names, because I do think that the MPs are more relaxed about this than perhaps some of the membership. But I think the timing is putting people off, and I think that's going to be very costly.
Now, Isabel, Ruth Davidson's endorsement was one that pretty much every candidate wanted. Here we've got the great Scottish Boudicca, the great conqueror, and everybody knows she doesn't like Boris, but she said she'll make her peace with him. Now, I'm wondering, why would they have gone ahead with her endorsement on Saturday when it was bound to get overtaken in the news agenda with Michael Gove and Cocaine? Because at 9:30, the Friday, the story broke. Then Sajid Javid's team announces Ruth's going to be endorsing him on Saturday. But on Sunday, still, it was eclipsed. And today you've got the sort of the main story is Amber Rudd backs Jeremy Hunt. Now, that's a smaller news story, perhaps, than Ruth Davidson backing Sajid Javid. But it seems, even in the campaign, the candidates are beginning to distinguish themselves and who are making shrewd media judgments and who... which ones are making little mistakes, which might give inkling of what might more be to come.
Yes, with Sajid Javid's campaign, there have been a number of strange errors. We've talked a lot about his launch video, where he didn't talk about his backstory at all. He was in his parliamentary office rather than standing on Stapleton Road in Bristol, you know, one of the most dangerous streets in Britain. And again, not working out where in the news cycle is most beneficial for you to unveil one of your big sort of political celebrity endorsers is another strange error, I think, particularly given that, you know, Jeremy Hunt managed to produce a more inspiring video with an exciting backstory when Jeremy Hunt comes from an incredibly privileged background. It's a very strange contradiction that Sajid Javid has. That's something that I've noticed at events and dinners, that he can oscillate between being incredibly funny, incredibly warm, full of belief and quite inspiring to the crowd that he speaks to, or being incredibly wooden and locking away all the things that are interesting about him behind this sort of very workmanlike exterior. And I think we're seeing quite a lot of the workmanlike stuff at the moment.
So, Katie, if Sajid Javid's personal glasnost is still a work in progress, might this Is there a scenario where this actually works in his favour because all the more colourful ones take each other out by the end of this contest?
I don't think it's the most likely scenario, but I can see a path where Sajid Javid still makes it to the final two. I think it would be a stretch, but he is in a way holding the line in terms of his numbers. He is adding some. I think what the Home Secretary has had today, which has been fairly good for him, is last week there was a fair bit of criticism that, look, no one from your own government department has come out for you. And there was a sense, as has been confirmed today, that Ben Wallace, Home Office Minister, was not going to back Sajid Javid, and instead Dad was going to go to the Boris Johnson camp.
He's been campaigning for Boris for the best part of 10 years.
I don't think it was really an indictment on Sajid Javid, but you could see how it could be spun if other ministers didn't come out. Now, he has got three of his Home Office ministers, including Victoria Atkins, seen as a rising star, and Caroline Noakes, coming out for him today. And I think
less of a rising star.
I didn't say anything. You can read from that what you want. And I think that helps him a bit. But yeah, I think with the Sajid Javid effort, it's really just about holding the line. And therefore, if other campaigns explode, he could be in the right place.
Holding the line is going to take on a different connotation now with all of this Toryism. But and I guess who we haven't heard a squeak from is Boris Johnson, who so far has played a blinder by saying not a word. So Isabel, this is like the Grand National, isn't it? The horse in front. You never know what's going to happen to them. Now, Boris, I guess we'll be able to tell how enduring he is going to be by the time he's actually spent a week speaking and giving answers to questions and seeing if he can avoid self-destruction meanwhile.
Yeah, all he's currently really doing is filing his Telegraph column, which must come as an immense relief to the comment desk there, given how late he often files. But beyond that, his campaign team's strategy has been to keep him away from the airwaves and stop him from talking.
It's
basically
been brilliant success.
I mean,
so far.
They're even nervous about the column. I spoke to one of them who said, oh, we are one Monday column away from disaster. It's an interesting approach from his campaign team to Boris, isn't it, that they have such little faith in him that they basically just want to lock him into a cupboard until they get to the final two, where they hope that he can just sort of rub his blonde hair a bit and that the Tory members will fall over themselves to vote for him.
I think we are going to see Boris Johnson put out a little bit more in the coming days. And we will be getting, for example, a leadership launch where we are told journalists will be allowed to ask him questions directly. So we don't know how many. Jeremy Hunt managed to hold 10 minutes of Q&A today. He had to do an extra run after he was heckled for trying to call it short. But I do think there is a sense that Boris Johnson, and I know perhaps we shouldn't be having to say this, I believe he will be doing broadcast media before the final two arrive.
And what do you think his cocaine answer is? Because he's bound to get asked that question. All of them will be thinking now, what do we say?
Well, I think the Boris Johnson camp have already pointed out his previous comments on this,
which were
to do with, I think, icing sugar, perhaps not actually being near enough.
Trying to snort it, but ended up sneezing. So
I think they'll probably revert back to that. I think Boris Johnson's personality means that there is so much out there already which could be weaponized against him.
So it's hard to shock people. There's nothing Boris could say that would realistically make somebody think less of him.
Except maybe admitting being part of the Hatton Garden robbery or something like that.
And even then, you do feel like he is harder to attack because there's so much already out there. But we are constantly reminded that the front runner rarely wins the race. So I don't want to tempt fate too much there.
Well, you'll be able to join us for this race line by line, as it were, on this podcast, Coffee House Shots. Isabel and Katie, thanks very much. And thanks to Cindy Yu, our producer.